Hello, K-Squid listeners. It's every other Sunday again, and you're listening to Sustainability Now, a bi-weekly K-Squid radio show focused on environment, sustainability, and social justice in the Monterey Bay region, California, and the world. I'm your host, Ronnie Lipschitz. My guest today on Sustainability Now is Mark Dowie, self-described cowhand guitarist, investigative historian, poet, and journalist. He's probably best known as co-founder, editor, and staff writer for Mother Jones, but during his more than 50-year career, he's also written for many other magazines, newspapers, and publications, written 8 books, and received no less than 19 journalism awards. His most recent book is Judith Letting Go, 6 Months in the World's Smallest Death Cafe, published in 2024. He's presently developing a podcast on the history of the U.S. Supreme Court, which will go live later this year. In 1995, Dowie published Losing Ground, American Environmentalism at the Close of the 20th Century. 30 years later, and 70-odd years since the beginning of that movement, we're going to talk about the U.S. environmental movement then and now. Mark Dowie, welcome to Sustainability Now.
Glad to be here.
Well, our mission today is to talk about Losing Ground, American Environmentalism at the Close of the 20th Century, which was published 30 years ago in 1995. And to talk about what things look like for American environmentalism after the first quarter of the 21st century. Have things changed, or are we looking at a lot more of the same? So before we do that, some backgrounds in order. So as I said to you, I couldn't find a Wikipedia page about you, so I looked elsewhere. And on Amazon, your bio reads, cowhand, guitarist, investigative historian, and poet, which is quite succinct. I mean, I like that. But it excludes journalist. And I think most people know you from your association with Mother Jones, which was, after all, a while ago. So maybe you could tell us how you got into journalism and what you've been doing since you did that, since you got into journalism.
Well, I'm sort of an accidental journalist. My training is in economics. I have an ABD in economics from the University of California. And I worked as an economist for years. And I found my way into publishing as a microeconomic profession. And I was the publisher of Mother Jones. And we had sent out a lot of email to, direct mail to new subscribers, promising that we were going to be a heavy-hitting investigative magazine. And the editors weren't delivering. So I broke the firewall and crashed an editorial meeting and said, hey, they're waiting for investigative material. Let's deliver. And the editors sort of whined a little bit and said, well, we really don't know how to do that. So I said, look, you walk into the lobby of any corporation or powerful institution in America, and you're going to find a story. So, and they said, well, if you're so good at it, why don't you do it if you know so much? So I started doing it. As a publisher, I started doing it. And my first story was a story about the Dalkon Shield intrauterine device, which got a lot of attention. And I wandered from there into one after another, almost all corporate investigative stories. And I've wandered from a career in investigative journalism into a career in investigative history, because our work always, journalism is the opener for history. I mean, it's where historians go to look for material into the mores of journalism. So I've become an investigative historian. I've written or five, I guess Losing Ground is one, investigative histories. So that's it.
Can you expand on that idea of investigative history? I mean, why is history important? Because, most Americans figure yesterday is past and it's a new day.
Well, the old thing, if you forget history, you're condemned to repeat it. History is very important. And revisionist history is part of the whole historical process. And investigative history is a branch of revisionist history. It's using the skills of an investigative journalist to write, research and write revisionist history. So that's what I've done, been doing for the last 10 years or more, 30 counting this book. So it's using investigative skills to write revisionist history.
I can't help but interjecting here Marx's comment about Hegel. And first time is history, second time is farce, right? As opposed to not forgetting the past. What books have you published besides Losing Ground in the past 30 years, just so our listeners know.
Well, Losing Ground led to a book called American Foundations, which is an investigative history of philanthropic foundations, mostly in America, although they are really an American phenomenon, although they were started in Persia before we started doing them. But that was my next book. After that was a book called Conservation Refugees, which is a century-long history of the conflict between global conservation and native people. And then I did one called, which came out of that book, called The Haida Gwaii Lesson, which was a story about how the indigenous nation of Haida Gwaii established sovereignty and title to their land. 50-year struggle that took place in Canada. And then that's it. I mean, I wrote a personal book about a friendship that I had, which is not really relevant to what we're discussing. So those are the key investigators. Previously to Losing Ground, I wrote an investigative history of organ transplantation and how it was affecting medicine, medical practice, and the whole industry of medicine. And I wrote actually two books on that subject. One of them was never published in English. It was translated into Dutch and I believe Japanese. But I count them as my books, even though no English readers can't read them.
Well, those are all worth, entire radio shows. But let's get back to Losing Ground. So when you wrote it, it was a sort of like a 30-year retrospective and critique of the U.S. environmental movement. And 1965, is a sort of an arbitrary date. But could you summarize the book and your arguments and your critical evaluation of American environmentalism at the time?
Yeah, the book actually happened. This is an interesting sideline too, sidebar. The book happened because I wrote an essay for a foreign policy journal, and the essay basically was saying that the American environmental movement was dangerously courting irrelevance, and that got a lot of attention for some reason, including attention from Teddy Goldsmith. Who was at the time a major environmental funder, mo using his m mostly his brother's money, Jimmy Goldsmith, and I got to know him. He was a pretty good guy, and he liked the essay, and he was also connected to MIT Press, so he showed it to them and said, "See, why don't you see if you can spin this up into a book?" And they called me and invited me to do it, offered a parsimonious advance that I couldn't afford to accept, so I said, "No, I can't." But they said, well, wait a minute. And they got the university to basically take me in as a research. So they weren't want to let me use the word fellow. I've forgotten what it is. Anyway, some kind of research contract. And I did that four times for MIT, and they published three of them. So that was Losing Ground was the first of three MIT books that I did, all of which were investigative histories.
Okay, but so summarize the
Yeah.
arguments in the book, right?
Well,
And
at the
your
time,
critique.
yeah, keep in mind that this is 25 years ago. Things have
Actually,
changed a lot.
30. It's 30 years ago, Mark.
I know. No, I know. But the turn of the subtitle is The Turn of the 20th Century, right?
Okay.
At the close of the 20th century. So at the close of the 20th century, I think the American environmental movement was courting irrelevance. And I think it was because, I'm for sure it was because, it had sort of evolved into this huge group. I mean, this small group of very huge organizations that called themselves the Green Group, that were all of the environmental organizations that we still know and hear about, the Sierra Club, the Nature Conservancy, and all of those groups, the World Wildlife Fund, that were then, and I think still are, vacuuming up about 70% of the economic resources that are going towards environmentalism. And that was and that those groups were pretty much ignoring, almost putting down the grassroots of the environmental movement. And as a consequence, the movement was not as effective as it could be, because all social movements require strong grassroots, and environmentalism is no exception. So that was sort of, in a nutshell, what the indictment of the book was.
Just again to give our listeners a background, those who weren't around at the time, what were the dominant themes and concerns of the movement in the in both the 60s and the 90s? I mean, did they change? And
Well, the
you know,
movement,
which organizations represented what?
yeah, well, the movement really began with conservation, a conservation impulse, and usually driven by a sort of upper class greens who liked hunting, fishing, and hiking in the woods. And that's sort of the early stages of environmentalism. That was the impulse, was conservation. That sort of shifted a little bit and gradually towards preservation, wildlife and wildland and wilderness preservation. And that's when groups like the Sierra Club and others grew into. And then it evolved from there towards more emphasis on charismatic megafauna, large animals that we had developed, that humans had developed an affection for, protecting them. And then eventually it became a more of a scientifically driven movement, with emphasis on pollution and biodiversity preservation. So by the end of the 20th century, it had become a fairly broad movement that included all of the things I've just talked about: conservation, preservation, pollution, opposing pollution, and I think climate was beginning to be debated as an issue then, but really didn't become a major environmental issue until more recently.
Well, in the book, you talk about people like Paul Ehrlich and Garrett Hardin, who were very much, focused on population growth at the time, and that was a fairly powerful stream. I think Fairfield Osborne, who you also talked about, was also quite concerned about that, if I remember correctly. What?
Well, almost an obsession, really. The Malthusian obsession was very big then. The whole idea that we were eating and breeding ourselves out of our carry the human carrying capacity of the planet, and that still may be an active theory embraced by a lot of environmentalists.
Yeah, every so often I see people referring to that, but it's always a matter of they are increasing in numbers, we're okay, right? Well, my introduction to American environmentalism came in the late 70s when I worked at the Union of Concerned Scientists. And at the time, it was funded primarily by the Kendall Foundation and operated out of this funky old pink building in Cambridge, a few blocks from Harvard Square. I don't know if you ever saw the building or were aware of it, but today it's more like a corporation. And this, what you mentioned earlier, this notion of the corporatization of those old environmental organizations is pretty much a characteristic of the big ones. Now, how did that come about? I mean, why did that happen?
Part of it is the corporatization of philanthropy. I mean, these organizations were all became very, very dependent on foundation philanthropy. I mean, foundations have grown enormously during the years that we're talking about here. And also the third wave of environmentalism. I mean, in Losing Ground, I divide the movement into four waves. And the third wave of environmentalism, which was the most recent going into this book, really, was the wave where environmentalists start collaborating with corporations who are attempting to green themselves by cozying up to the Nature Conservancy and the more conservative members of the Green Group, and forming collaborations and cooperations with them. And that at that point, I think that the 25 or so members of the Green Group became much more corporate. I mean, all of their headquarters are in Washington. If you go to them, they're indistinguishable from the headquarters of any company anywhere. In fact, I was covering at the same time I was doing this, I was covering something in the Pentagon. Doing something in the Pentagon, it was easier to get into the Pentagon than it was to get into the Nature Conservancy. I mean, they had more security at the doors of every office in the Nature Conservancy when I was in Washington. It became incredibly corporate.
You're listening to Sustainability Now. My name is Ronnie Lipschitz. I'm your host. And my guest today is Mark Dowie, who in his lifetime has been cowhand, a guitarist, an investigative historian, and a poet, amongst other things. And we've just been talking about the corporatization of the big environmental organizations, you know, back around 1990 and 1995. You know, you mentioned that the philanthropic organizations, the foundations, grew enormously. And of course, they've gotten even bigger since then, particularly with all of the tech money that has been flowing into, you know, God knows where. But the other sort of impetus is growth. The more people you hire, the bigger your payroll. And the more payroll you have, the more you have to sort of struggle to make it every month. And the foundations, it seems to me, we're not, you know, paying for all of that. And of course, this was also when the whole idea of neoliberalism started to manifest, market theories of environmental protection. Does that raise any, I mean, were you observing that at the time?
Well, yeah. And I mean, I'm not to imply that foundations were the sole funders of the environmental movement, far from it. All of those organizations have huge memberships. But and their memberships are, you know, $25 to $100 donors who really are essential to. So a big driving force in their organization is membership management and membership accumulation and everything. And that's a big, big part of it. In fact, a lot of people who are employed by environmentalist organizations have nothing to do with the environment. I mean, all the way up to the top. I mean, Pete Seligman is one of the best fundraisers I've ever known seen working in my life. But I don't regard him as an environmentalist. I regard him as a fundraiser. And he's, you know, been the CEO of more than one nature conservancy and CI. And it's because he is an ace fundraiser. And I can tell you amazing stories about his fundraising accomplishments. But that's true throughout the movement. It's the drive, as you say, is to support the offices and support. I mean, CI has 80 offices around the world.
It's Conservation International, right?
Yeah. That is a huge, huge budget item supporting all those offices. And they have planes and boats and cars and everything and fleets of everything to go with it. Things that have nothing to do with the environment, except perhaps damaging it a little bit. So yeah, they're gigantic organizations that on paper are doing stuff for the environment, but really aren't doing very much.
Well, you talked about several different strategies that environmental organizations deploy to gain influence and grow: popularization, legislation, and litigation. And at the time, you mentioned that membership was declining. In 1995, right? Membership was declining. There was growing opposition in Congress and declining success in the courts. So can you talk about this sort of three-pronged strategy and how it was deployed and if anything has changed since then?
I'm not sure I know what you mean by the three-pronged strategy.
Well, I said, you know, one is signing up members, you know, as you mentioned, yeah. Like large numbers of members. The second one is trying to get laws passed.
Oh, yeah.
Right. And then the third one is going to the courts, which remains very, very important. So how do those, you know, maybe you can expand on those.
I think they're all still driving forces of the movement, of environmentalism and the movement. And I think they're important to the movement. I mean, you want to bring people in. You want to get people active. Not just as donors, but as activists. So membership and active membership is important. And I think the best environmental organizations are organizations that do activate their members, not just ask them for $25 a month. So membership and litigation goes on. I mean, three or four of the biggest environmental organizations are law firms, NRDC and EDF. And the Sierra Club Legal Defense Fund are law firms. And that's their whole thing, is litigating environmental cases against polluters, against government agencies, against anyone who's doing any kind of damage to the environment and the corporations that are lying about it, et cetera. So there's still a lot of litigation. That hasn't changed at all, really. And lobbying for legislation, same. It's still going on. All of the big groups have at least one lobbyist in Washington. I think last time I counted, there were 27 paid environmental lobbyists in Washington. I think way more than that now.
That, of course, I suppose, pales in comparison to the number of corporate and other lobbyists.
Sure.
That's still fairly small.
And
Maybe,
not very effective because, I mean,
well.
lobbying is giving money, right? And so if you're going up on the Hill and trying to persuade a congressman to vote one way or another, a bill, or sponsor a bill that is an environmental bill, the polite congresspeople will listen to you, but they'll open the next person that's coming in is someone with money from a corporation, and that's who they really listen to. So I'm a little bit cynical about environmental lobbying.
Well, it's perfectly respectable to be cynical about it. I mean, and laws often have outcomes that are quite different from at least what one assumes their goals are.
Exactly.
And even well-established ones can be overturned or turned over depending on the whims of Congress and the courts. Did you, by the way, have you been following this latest brouhaha about Exxon and plastics, which is
Plastics, yes. I mean, just as an American media consumer, not
Yeah.
as a historian or an environmental, but yeah, I have. And plastics are one of the new big. I mean, there's been a lot of mission drifting in the environmental movement over the last 25 years, and plastics have become one of the hot topics. You know, greenhouse gases, plastics, biodiversity loss, and sea level and environmental justice. So the new missions now of environmentalism, which they weren't so much so at the turn of the 20th century. But so plastics, yeah, and I have been following the plastic story, but not carefully. I'm not an expert by any means.
Well, just to summarize, the state of California and several environmental organizations filed suit in California against Exxon for misleading essentially the public on plastics recycling. I think the numbers I saw this morning was something like Exxon produces 6 million tons of plastics a year and has managed to recycle 79 million pounds. But Exxon filed suit in Texas against the Attorney General of California and these organizations, accusing them of, smears and libels. And so we're set for this battle royale, I suppose, between dueling lawsuits and dueling courts. It does raise the question, I guess, as well about the relative effectiveness of law and litigation in trying to protect the environment.
Well, Exxon has been in court a lot for the last 50 years. I mean, for lying about fossil fuels and lying about air pollution and lying about, I mean, that's their, and their métier is to fight back with their own countersuits and everything. That doesn't, and the, which they're doing now with plastics, and that doesn't surprise me at all. But plastics is, I think plastics is something the whole world has to contend with, not just ExxonMobil, but then ExxonMobil is in the plastics business because the raw material of plastic is oil. But there's plenty of other bad actors in the plastics industry that we need to contend with.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't doubt that, but I thought it was interesting that that this particular oil company has decided to fight back on this particular count. A lot of the environmental legislation of the 60s and 70s became institutionalized. I mean, I think we assumed that the Endangered Species Act, for instance, and the Clean Air Act were institutionalized, and yet there have been continuing efforts to reverse those laws. And it seems likely that the Trump 2.0 administration, along with Congress and the Supreme Court, are going to undermine what laws and regulations are still in place. Do you have any sort of thoughts about how the big environmental organizations are likely to respond to this and to act on it?
I think all environmentalists should be deeply concerned about the incoming administration. This is not going to be a friendly administration to the environment. I mean, drill, baby, drill. He's going to start right away. He's probably going to reverse all of the drilling restrictions that Biden has put in recently. This is not going to be a green administration. We know that. I don't know, because I'm not following this anymore, how environmentalists are planning or lining up to contend with the new administration, but you can be sure they are. I mean, they're as alarmed as you and I are about what's about to happen, and not just in environmentalism, in everything.
Yeah, in the book, you point out that the U.S. environmental movement was never a singular phenomenon. It was splintered, as you term it, even before the 60s in many ways. But in the book, you list a whole bunch of environmental ideologies. I'm not quite sure what to, else to call them, or streams of thought or something like that. And proponents of each believed that they had devised the solution to the environmental crisis. And I'm thinking here about market environmentalism and eco-Marxism and eco-feminism and Earth First kind of stuff. These were sort of different,
Deep ecology.
deep ecology, and they were all sort of philosophically linked, but at the same time, not the same in terms of, what the solution was. What would you say is the dominant ideology today? Maybe you can say a little bit about what those were, and then in light of that large number, I think you had 12 or 15 listed there, and there are probably more. Is there a dominant one today?
Well, that's a good question. And, as I say, I haven't been following it closely enough to really give you a good answer. I mean, I think that the fact that most people with environmental sensibilities in the world today are concerned about the climate. And I think the climate is driving the mission of environmentalism in most countries of the world right now, where environmentalism is a movement. And and obviously the low-lying countries are maybe a little more concerned about sea level things, but the and I don't know if there is a single environmental ideology or ecology that is driving the movement right now. I don't think there is, actually. I think they're all still there, and they're all still sort of debating what environmentalism means and what needs to be done. It's not a unified movement, never was. I'm not sure it should be, but and I always welcome a diversity of philosophies in a social movement. I think they help drive the movement, and they stop the movement from becoming attached to and defending only one idea or one philosophy or one ideology. So it's a multi-ideological movement, and I think it always has been and always will be, and that's good.
But at the same time, it makes it somewhat difficult to develop, effective coalitions, doesn't it?
No, I don't think so. And I don't know. I don't. I haven't found that to be true. I think the coalitions have and c can be formed between if the mission is singular and the mission is environment. I don't think it matters whether two members of a coalition come into that mission from different ideological positions. I don't think that's hurt coalitions at all.
You're listening to Sustainability Now. I'm Ronnie Lipschitz, and my guest today is Mark Dowie, who many people know as a journalist from his time at Mother Jones, but he's done many other things. And we're talking about his 1995 book, Losing Ground, which is about the environment, U.S. environmental movement at the turn of the 20th century. Since it's 30 years later, I asked him to do some reflecting on what, if anything, has changed since 1995. How do you assess American environmentalism in 2025? And has anything changed since you wrote Losing Ground?
Well, I think a lot has. I mean, first of all, the whole environmental movement has become way more global over the last 25 years than it was. I mean, with the COP meetings and international cooperation and collaboration on big environmental issues, and not just climate, but other things and plastics and things that we've already mentioned. So I think the movement, the American movement, which kind of drove the global movement for a long time, I think has less significance and less power in the overall global movement. That's one thing that's happened. I think there have been enormous technological advances that have affected environmentalism, particularly towards the development of renewable energy, et cetera. I think one of the things I'm heartened by is the number of the extent with youth has been drawn into this movement. I think there are a lot more young greens than there were at the turn of the century. I mean, I think the green groups are still hogging an excessive percentage, probably 70 still, of the resources that are going into environmental activism. And I always encourage people who ask, how should I spend my environmental charity, my environmental dollar? And I just say, put half into your watershed and half outside of your watershed. So I think we need local environmentalism and grassroots environmentalism needs more support. And if we take a little away from the green groups to get that local support, all the better, I think.
Now, in the book, you suggested a fourth wave might materialize in the 21st century, fourth wave of environmentalism. And if I can read the paragraph in the book and ask you how you reflect on that. A redefined environmentalism will come gradually through a synthesis of classical environmentalism and the emerging ecologies. The fourth wave environmental ideology will lean cautiously toward the human and nature worldview and blend primitive Earth wisdom with the verities of modern scientific ecology. It will respectfully reject the anthropocentrism of humanist, Marxist, and Judeo-Christian traditions, challenge the Newtonian Cartesian view, and call for a new philosophy of nature, a new ecological ethos that says, quote, "We are aware now of our impact on the environment and the planet. The next step is to see ourselves as citizens of nature," unquote. Or to paraphrase Thomas Berry, human beings will reapply for membership in the biosphere. As I read it, it sounds actually pretty accurate, but what's your reaction?
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that because I think it's turned out to be pretty accurate. And I don't have any reaction to it. I still think it was a pretty good prediction, and I think most of what I expected would happen has happened. And I'm heartened by that.
In Losing Ground, you took note of an emerging coalition between social justice and environmental organizations and talked about, in particular, I think there was a conference in the early 1990s that started to mobilize organizations, social justice organizations, around the theme of environmental justice. So, since it was new at the time, how did you describe it and regard it and assess that?
Well, I think that you've worded it politely, the emergence of social justice organizations, and they're becoming a little more concerned about where they interacted with and overlapped with environmentalism. I mean, another way to describe it is people of color crashed the movement. I mean, the environmental movement up until that time was a lily white movement, and in fact, it was a racist movement. Sierra Club supported whites only in national parks, if you go back far enough in the 1920s and 30s. So it was a lily white movement, and to some degree, still is. But there is this arm, branch, wing of the movement that marches under the term environmental justice that is trying to diversify the movement, and I think has been quite successful doing so. There are now Native American Greens. There are now Black Greens in America. There weren't until probably the early 1990s when Bob Bullard crashed a meeting and said, "You got to pay attention to us." And somebody crashed the IUCN meeting, a man named Martin Sanango, and said, "You have to pay attention to us too." And so conservationists and environmentalists and anti-pollutionists and everybody finally got a message from people like saying, other people saying, "Yeah, we're getting poisoned too." And that became a driving force in the movement as it is today. So environmental justice is a big, big part of environmental activism and environmental emphasis and organization today.
You mentioned it led to your next book, Conservation Refugees. Can you tell us about that?
I mean, Conservation Refugees is an investigative history of the relationship between global conservation and native people around the world. Again, I opened the book with the anecdote I just mentioned, a meeting of the IUCN that we're talking about conservation and all of the And this man stood up and said, "We used to consider big mining, big timber, big ranching, and all the big industries to be our major enemies. And now you, conservation, have become our number one enemy, Native people's enemies." And he'd done his research and found that in Africa, about 14 million people, where he was from, Martin Senegal, had been evicted from their traditional homelands, either directly by or at the insistence of big global organizations, environmental and conservation organizations. So conservation was driving Native people off their land because Native people were hunting bushmeat or doing what the environmentalists called slash and burn agriculture. And they were doing things that were detracting from the aesthetics of conservation of wildlands and conservation, and it was affecting tourism. And so they started evicting about 100 years ago, starting evicted Native people, and created a huge class of what I call conservation refugees, after which I named the book. And that, to a degree, is still going on. The protection of endangered species in Africa, in the interest of doing that, the World Wildlife Fund has hired people who are killing animal poachers because who are just killing animals so that they can eat protein. And but you know, some of the species that they're killing are of interest to conservationists, animal conservationists, wildlife conservationists, and they're patrolling the jungles against the Batwa and other people who are living on jungle protein. It's you know, it's a struggle over food security, really. But it's also created an enormous number of refugees around the world driven out by conservation.
There still remains a big focus on megafauna, charismatic megafauna, right? As opposed to the smaller species, some of whom are less attractive, and of course, the bugs and the insects and the like. And that's all connected to tourism, to people going on safaris and in their jeeps and looking at big animals. But I mean, I'm sort of struck by the idea that the original displacement had to do with mining and logging and extraction of material resources.
Well, that's what Martin Senegal said. He said they used to be our enemies. Our number one enemies used to be big industry, big mining, big. And now it isn't anymore. You are conservation. And he said that this was an international gathering of the IUCN,
International Union for the Conservation of Nature. I don't remember if you mentioned that or not.
That's right.
And it's a sort of a semi-governmental organization, I think.
It is
what
now.
Its status is. Yeah.
Governments and corporations, they have 10,000 members, and some of them are government and some of them are corporate, but very few of them are green.
Tell us a little bit about how you went about writing this book.
Which one?
The Conservation Refugees.
I got tipped off about it when I was making a speech in Ottawa, and a Chippewa woman leaned over my shoulder and said, "You ought to look into conservation refugees." And I asked her what she meant. And that started me on this. And, you know, I started traveling. I went to every continent. I went to over 100 indigenous communities that were basically refugee camps of people who'd been kicked off their land by conservation. And this has been going on around the world, mostly in Africa, but probably in every country of the world to some degree. It took me about 4 years to document it all, and the book is, I think, probably 15 chapters of the worst offenses in the whole process of evicting people in the interest of conservation. But I cover the whole issue as well in the book.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there have been a lot of academics who have written extensively about this, you know, since the early 90s. I guess the real question is, what has changed, if anything?
I think there's less of it happening. Some of the Native people isolated five huge conservation organizations that they called the Bingos. The Bingo stands for Big International NGO.
Uh-huh.
We've already talked about some of them: Conservation International, the Nature Conservancy, the World Wildlife Fund, Wildlife Fund for Nature, and Wildlife Conservation Society. And they're gigantic organizations all headquartered in Washington, that have been driving the conservation refugee problem in the world for most of the time it's been happening. And I think to one degree or another agree with my indictment that they have not been doing the right thing. Some of them have, I mean, Pete Seligman, who is the founder of, a co-founder of Nature Conservancy and Conservation International, went off and started a third group, which is just for conservation refugees and just for people who've lost their land and interest. And I'm not sure how sincere that is, but I the foundations that read the book went back to the bingos and said, you've got to change. You've got to stop doing this. And I mean, and even some of the big funders like Gordon Moore went after, he's probably the largest single environmental grant maker in the United States, if not the world. And he went back to some of the organizations like CI, which he had given like $500 million to, and said, you've got to stop this. And so there's been a curtailment, I would say, but not a complete end to the eviction of people in the interest of conservation. But the whole what has been stimulated is a sub-movement, which you might call indigenous conservation, where Native people are being brought into the conservation process. So community-based conservation has been driven and created by this new response to the conservation refugee indictment.
You're listening to Sustainability Now. I'm your host, Ronnie Lipschitz. My guest today is Mark Dowie, who many people know as one of the prime movers behind Mother Jones in the 1970s. We've just been talking about one of his books, Conservation Refugees. And correct me if I'm wrong, the 100-year conflict between conservation and, I didn't quite get that right. What was
Native
the last
people.
Native peoples, yeah.
But
Native
it's global,
peoples.
Global conservation. It's,
global conservation, yeah.
Not local, global conservation.
No, and you know, I sort of imagine that this is still going on in various guises.
Oh yeah.
Well, we're getting close to the end of our time together, and I wanted to go back to losing ground, because again, toward the end, you have this list of tenets and characteristics, you call them, that you thought in 1995 would become sort of conventional wisdom and practice in the 21st century. You didn't specify when in the 21st century, of course. That still leaves 75 years. If I can read it, I'd like to sort mm-hmm. of ask you about each one.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Fortunately, Americans are an eclectic people. Out of the potpourri of ideas described in the next few sections will emerge a new environmental imagination. It's impossible to predict exactly what form it will take, but from the common ground around the competing philosophies, one can safely pick up the following tenets and characteristics. Anthropocentrism will become passé. And I want you to just sort of quickly respond, you know, to whether you think we've gotten there yet.
Not yet, but I think we're moving away from anthropocentric thinking, and not just regarding the environment, but regarding, you know, overall philosophy in general. I think we are moving away from it, yes.
Humanity will be returned to nature and will no longer be considered the crowning achievement of evolution. Well, you've got evolution in there, and there are a lot of people who I think still don't believe in that. So,
yeah, well, I mean, I think most Greens and environmental activists and leaders believe in evolution. So I'm not worried about the people who don't. They're always going to be around. You know, and it's, to me, what's heartening about the relationship between environmentalism and Christianity is that Christians are starting to become much greener than they used to be. I mean, they were sort of going by God's admonition to dominate nature, and they're moving away from that to seeing nature as God's creation and as something that they, as well as everyone else, needs to protect.
All existing economic orthodoxies will be challenged.
Well, all orthodoxies are constantly challenged. You know that.
Well, but
that was an easy one.
That was an easy one. At the same time, you know, will they be challenged effectively, I guess, is the question. Sustainability will be clearly defined, well understood, and taught in school.
Well, sustainability, and pardon me, I know this is part of the title of your presentation.
No, no offense taken at all.
My friend Sim Vandran, who died recently, once said that sustainability was the phrase that's driven 1,000 conferences. I mean, it became, I suspended it from my own use for a full year. I do that every year. I take a word that's being overused and abused, and I just stop using it myself. And sustainability was my choice. I've forgotten what year it was, but because it was just being so incorrectly defined and overused. Corporations were talking about sustainability, you know that.
Yeah, of course.
It became a joke for a while. But I think it's a meaningful word, and I think it needs to be redefined and reapplied to many, many things, not just environmentalism.
Clean air, clean water, and arable land will be considered basic human rights.
Yeah, and I think they should. And I think they are to a degree. I mean, people are certainly asking that certainly clean water, clean air and water be defined legally as basic human rights. And I'm working now on a podcast about the US Supreme Court. And one of the things that is emerging in the critique of not just the court, but jurisprudence generally is that it's time now to give nature and ecosystems standing and in courts, which means that the trees can come to court and ask for the court's protection, trees and animals and other things besides humans and human organizations. So I think that is happening. And I think that the rights of nature will be a driving force of American jurisprudence for the next few years.
Environmental justice will be litigated as a basic right and tried as such before federal and state supreme courts.
Well, that is happening. And so that was a prediction that I made, what, in 1995 or whenever it was, and that is happening. Tons and tons of environmental justice litigation, and a big, big part now of the whole COP and global climate initiative is driven now by people who are saying we need to be in this part of this indictment and part of this movement as well. So environmental justice is moving into global environmentalism as well.
Toxic pollution will change from a misdemeanor to a felony and be punished as such.
Well, to a degree, that's happened. I mean, people have been indicted for toxic pollution, and of course, the whole Superfund thing was an attempt to isolate really, really bad toxic pollution sites and remediate them. So yeah, and people and corporations have been indicted several times for toxic pollution.
And finally, a land ethic will be taught in nursery school.
Well, that was kind of wishful thinking. I'd have to say, I think at the time I had grandchildren in nursery school, the time I said that. But, and I was just hoping that, I mean, I think what I was saying, that was a flip way of saying that we need to educate people all the way through the system on these issues that are so vital to us all, and activate children when they're, and get children interested in environmentalism and in actively protecting their environment as youngsters. So it
Well,
was wishful thinking rather than a prediction.
I think you're correct on that one, although I mean the land ethic invokes Aldo Leopold, right? But what I used to say to people was when I was in K through six, I learned geography about products of different countries, right? And now kids learn about the environment. So I mean there has been that change. Okay, well, is there anything else you'd like to mention before we wrap things up?
No, I think you've cobbled together a great list of questions and reminded me of things I'd almost forgotten and stimulated a good conversation, I think. But I hope your audience does as well.
Okay. Well, Mark, thank you so much for being my guest on Sustainability Now.
No problem. Happy to be here.
You've been listening to a Sustainability Now interview with Mark Dowie, self-described cowhand, guitarist, investigative historian, poet, and journalist. He's probably best known as co-founder, editor, and staff writer for Mother Jones. Our conversation has focused on his 1995 book, Losing Ground: American Environmentalism at the Close of the 20th Century. As he mentioned, he is presently developing a podcast on the history of the U.S. Supreme Court, which will go live sometime in 2025. If you'd like to listen to previous shows, you can find them at ksquid.org/sustainabilitynow and Spotify, YouTube, and Pocket Casts, among other podcast sites. So thanks for listening, and thanks to all the staff and volunteers who make K-Squid your community radio station and keep it going. And so until next every other Sunday, Sustainability Now. Good planet.